Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. My name is Peter Walters, and this edition has been recorded on Wednesday, the 27th of August, 2025. Coming up in this week's programme, we're hearing about the Mid-Derbyshire Badger Group, of all people. We're on the Thames with Thames dweller Georgina Moore, who lives in one of the UK's largest houseboat communities. And we're a long way away from Warwickshire, hearing explorer Mark Wood talking about taking disabled to the Arctic. All that plus our regular features of sport and postbag. But first of all, here's the news from Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Coventry City owner Doug King has bought the CBS Arena from Mike Ashley's Frasers Group, finally bringing the stadium and the football club together after two decades. The deal came on the 20th anniversary match of the Sky Blues' first ever game at their home ground against QPR on August the 20th in 2005. And they were, coincidentally, last week's visitors to the Coventry Building Society Arena, formerly the Rico Arena. Doug King's purchase brings an end to 20 years of uncertainty and acrimony with previous owners, which led to two ground chair moves away from the city, but opens the way for a new secure future for the Sky Blues. It will also provide the football club with new revenue streams, one of the many issues former club owner Sisu had, feeling they didn't have a fair share of profits from food, beverages and car parking on match days, and arguments about their annual rental charge. Complete ownership will bring an end to all that while opening up revenue from the stadium's day-to-day events, including conferences and concerts which run all year round. How much King has paid for the arena is unknown at this stage, but Ashley's Frasers Group bought it in November 2022 after making a £17 million bid for the three businesses that ran the stadium, which had been placed into administration. At that time, former Newcastle United chairman pipped King to the purchase, despite the Stratford-based businessman making a £25 million move for the stadium himself at that time, which had been run by Arena Coventry Limited. For the first time since the ground was built, the club now owns its home. This milestone secures long-term stability, safeguards the future, and opens new opportunities for growth on and off the pitch. Doug King said, "Today is a defining day for Coventry City Football Club. For too long, the question of stadium ownership has cast uncertainty over our future. By bringing the arena under the club's ownership, we are safeguarding not only the present, but the future generations. This is our home, and it now belongs to the football club and its supporters."
A leading economist who has worked on schemes including HS2 has been brought in by the West Midlands Mayor to advise on a multi-million pound transport scheme which aims to deliver dozens of rail, bus, tram, road, cycle and walking projects across the entire region. Mayor Richard Parker has appointed Bridget Rosewell CBE to promote independent advice with a focus on the region's £2.4 billion Transport for City Regions package, with Coventry among the areas set to benefit. Announcing the funding, the Mayor said, "This is a huge investment in transport in our region, and it will make it easier and more affordable for everyone, from Coventry to the Black Country, to get to work, school, college, hospital, or anywhere across the West Midlands. Millions of people rely on our transport network every day, and now we're going to make sure it works for everyone. It is expected that the new advisor will work alongside the Mayor and West Midlands leaders, including Councillor George Duggins at Coventry City Council. Together they hope to identify new opportunities for infrastructure-led growth to ensure it is the best value for money. The Mayor explained, this is about making every pound work harder for the people of the West Midlands. We can make that £2.4 billion go further if we explore creative ways quickly to deliver infrastructure and mechanisms like tax incremental finance. That would mean we use the initial fund to catalyse billions more and crowd in private investment behind public funds. Bridget Rosewell brings the independent expertise we need to make sure our projects deliver jobs, growth and homes alongside better transport for local people.
Work is underway on expanding the A&E waiting room at University Hospital Coventry. Its capacity will increase from 47 seats to 74 seats. Bosses say a new room for blood tests will also be created as part of the refurbishment project. Patients will also be able to speak to clinicians privately when the build is completed. Contractors will be on site for a month, with little impact on patients in the first 2 weeks of the project. Alterations are being made to the back offices and the existing reception desk is being replaced. Patients will need to enter via the ambulance entrance to be triaged during the final 2 weeks of the project. New flooring, lighting and ceiling will be installed, with hoarding erected around the building. Justin Richards, Chief Strategy and Transformation Officer at University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire North Trust, said, extending the emergency department waiting room has been a priority, and we are delighted to see work begin. It is important that we listen to the community we serve, and both patients and visitors told us this was an area they wanted to see improved. We have one of the largest trauma centres in the country, with more than 270,000 visits per year, and this development will offer an enhanced environment for each and every person who comes through our doors. We apologise for any inconvenience visitors and patients may experience while the work is carried out, but look forward to having a spacious, modern facility for the long term.
EDF is offering a winter support package to UK households struggling with the cost of living crisis. The energy firm, which competes with OVO, E.ON Next, Octopus Energy and British Gas, aims to assist households in managing escalating energy debt while advocating for broader reforms to safeguard consumers. Despite fewer households falling behind on bills compared to last year, those who are finding it tough now owe an average of 28% more, equating to roughly £948 per household. The newly announced £30 million support fund is designed to provide debt relief, personalised assistance and advice via charities. According to EDF's data, early intervention proves effective, with 9 out of 10 customers who were assisted in 2024 remaining debt-free for at least a year. Debt levels are predicted to climb further when the Ofgem price cap increases in October, with the average bill expected to hit £1,744. The proposals include a suitably funded debt relief scheme, additional reforms to the warm home discount, and a central database of vulnerable households to enable earlier and more efficient outreach. EDF plans to collaborate with Tell Joe to utilise data to identify and assist at-risk customers sooner, and to expand expert frontline teams so that more customers with complex needs can receive bespoke hands-on help. Furthermore, it will reintroduce Sunday Saver in September, providing free electricity on Sundays to customers who reduce usage during the rest of the week. Philippe Commeret, Managing Director of Customers at EDF, stated, "We know that when people engage early, we can help them get out of debt and stay out. Last year's debt clearance success proves it works, with thousands of households supported and the vast majority remaining debt-free. But too many customers are struggling in silence until what they owe becomes unmanageable. We need a system that reaches people sooner and protects the most vulnerable while keeping costs fair for everyone. And that means government, Ofgem and the industry acting together now."
GCSE results for students in Coventry this year were impressive achievements. Many excelled in their GCSE and vocational qualification, outperforming their nationally benchmarked predictions. English results were strong this year, with two-thirds of Coventry schools reporting an improvement in the proportion of students achieving passes in grades 9 to 5. The 2025 results show that 41% of pupils achieve grades 9 to 5 in English and maths. 61% achieved a standard pass in maths and English. Attainment 8 results across 8 different subjects remain broadly consistent, and there were improvements in maths and English grades up to 58.5% for English and 73.1% for maths. Cabinet Member for Education and Skills at Coventry City Council, Councillor Dr. Kindy Sandu, said, "These young people have demonstrated incredible resilience and determination throughout their school years. They now have exciting opportunities ahead, whether continuing in education, entering training, or starting apprenticeships. I would like to express my gratitude to the families, teachers, and school staff who have supported students along the way. It takes a whole opportunity to prepare young people for their exams, and thanks to that collective effort, our students have achieved excellent results. I'm proud of what they've accomplished." Director of Children and Education Services, Sukrita Sen, added, "Congratulations to all our students and our family of schools on their 2025 results. I am very proud of what they have managed to achieve. This really shows young people's commitment and resilience, and I wish them every success as they build on these results."
Following up on our earlier report, the plans to demolish the Grade 2 listed swimming pool attached to Coventry's Elephant Leisure Centre have divided opinion among residents. A decision on the building's future could be made by the end of the year. The pool, which has been closed since 2020, is currently costing around £400,000 a year simply to maintain. Hopes remain that the elephant itself, that is, the distinctive structure straddling Cox Street, could be saved, with talks ongoing between Coventry City Council and developers. Councillor Jim O'Boyle responded after a petition urging the council to modernise and reopen the elephant gained 725 signatures. "Signing petitions is easy, but running things is difficult," he said. "The elephant and the swimming pool were decommissioned for sporting use over 10 years ago. There was a piece of work done by the previous administration which looked at what was there, and they worked with Swim England and various other bodies. Reluctantly, they eventually came to the conclusion that it simply wasn't fit for purpose. While the elephant itself is not listed, the swimming pool is protected due to its unusual winged roof and glazing." Councillor Boyle added, "Ultimately, the swimming pool is falling down, and it will be a heart decision rather than a business decision for someone to take it on. I've spent many happy hours there and I love the place, but I cannot justify the taxpayer spending £400,000 each year maintaining an empty building that has no potential future use. That's just unacceptable and needs to end." However, one resident commented, "It's such a shame to see an empty building. The facilities could still be used for sports events, fitness and well-being. It's part of Coventry history and infrastructure. I think they should save it. I absolutely hate the wave. There's nothing to do there. It's too small and not relaxing." Another added, "I used to visit the place twice a week, and while the decay was evident even then, it was obviously deliberate. It could have had the potential still to be great if it had been maintained, but the council clearly were just waiting for an excuse to demolish it one day. Once they closed it, this was an inevitable decision, and it's such sad news. A further added, about time it went. Yep, full of memories for Coventry pensioners, but of little value, and is well past its use-by date.
Police have launched an investigation into a series of shed and garage burglaries in Coventry. Four garage break-ins were reported in Longford, and garden sheds were raided in Bablake and Radford. Three garages on Kansan Road were broken into in the early hours of last Wednesday. Nothing was taken, as the offenders were disturbed and quickly fled. Officers also received reports that a garden shed had been broken into on Alderman's Green Road. It happened between 8 p.m. on August the 19th and 11:35 a.m. the next day. Sheds have also been burgled in Bablake and Radford. Thieves snapped the padlock off a shed door in Lincroft Crescent in Chapelfields and made off with items. Another shed was broken into on Quayside Court between 2 a.m. and 9 a.m. on August the 16th. Thieves made off with a Carrera bicycle, which is yet to be recovered. Police urge people with information on the Alderman's Green Road shed break-in to get in touch with them by calling 101. A spokesman said, if you heard or saw anything that may be suspicious, please contact us on 101. Appealing for information on the break-ins on Kansan Road, Coventry Police said, we have had multiple garage and shed break-ins in Longford. Three garages were broken into on Kansan Road. If you heard or saw anything that may be suspicious, please contact us on 101.
A new future has been assured for Coventry's Bistro Pierre. Early this month, it was revealed that the French restaurant chain was set to close the eatery in Cathedral Lanes in Broadgate. But now, a sign in the window of the restaurant has revealed a new future for the building. It is a letter that explains that an application has been made for a new premises licence. This has been made by Coventry Dining Limited and explains that the application is for a licence for Olive Tree. The application notice gives no further details on the venue, but it does ask for consumption of alcohol on and off the premises, as well as provision of live recorded music from 10 a.m. until midnight, Monday to Sunday. It also asks for the go-ahead to provide late-night refreshments from 11 until midnight, and also for opening hours of 8 a.m. until 12:30 a.m. 7 days a week. The City Council is currently considering the application, and as part of this, public consultation is held. Details of the application can be found on the public register on the Council's website.
Plans to build houses on an existing pub car park in Coventry have hit a major stumbling block after planning officers refused to grant permission. An application submitted back in June sought permission to build two three-bedroomed houses at the Auction House pub, previously known as the Bell Inn, on Station Avenue in Tile Hill. Were permission granted, the development would have come with associated parking and landscaping, as well as reconfiguration of public house car park with new vehicular access. But the plans were not warmly received by some locals, who not only raised objections, but also started an online petition in a bid to scupper the pub's owners' plans. It would appear the City Council's planning officers have weighed up the application and decided they agree with the pub's neighbours, and they refused the plan. The officer report reads... The contrived layout of the proposed access for the public house fails to consider the needs of vehicle movements entering and leaving the site, or take into account surrounding factors, including presence of the bus stop, landscaping, on-street parking, and use of the 180-degree turning point by domestic and commercial vehicles. The resulting access proposal is deemed to be detrimental to the safety of highway users and exhibits a poor quality design, which would have wider implications upon the surrounding area. Excuse me. The objections raised by locals included concerns it would exacerbate existing parking issues and have a detrimental impact upon the surrounding highway network. Loss of privacy, resultant overlooking and being out of character with area were also mentioned.
A legendary British actor passed away without a penny to his name, despite his remarkable career, leaving his wife dependent on Universal Credit to survive. Tony Booth was most famous for portraying Mike Rawlins in 52 episodes of the BBC sitcom Till Death Do Us Part. No, that's Till Death Us Do Part. Though he also appeared in ITV soap operas, featuring in 5 Coronation Street episodes and 1 Emmerdale instalment. It was his Coronation Street colleague Pat Phoenix, who portrayed Elsie Tanner on the famous street, who initially cared for a penniless Tony after he nearly perished in a blaze at his apartment. He relocated to live with the actress following years of rivalry on television, and the couple ultimately chose to wed just 7 days before Pat's heartbreaking death at the age of 62. Tony subsequently remarried twice, initially to Nancy Jager in 1988 before their separation in 1996, and then to Stephanie Buckley in 1998, remaining married until his passing at 85 in 2017. Tragically, Tony had received an Alzheimer's diagnosis in 2004 before experiencing a stroke in 2010. His condition deteriorated further. He battled chronic heart failure and obstructive pulmonary disease during his final years. His death, following years of being unable to earn income, left his widow Steph dependent on Universal Credit after spending tens of thousands of pounds on his medical expenses, which depleted their finances and rendered them both destitute. She explained, "When Tony died, we were broke. I had no income for 5 years and we'd used all our savings. All the benefits stopped and I had absolutely nothing. No husband, no income, nothing. It was such a shock. I lived on Universal Credit for 6 months. It was horrible to be that low." Steph was eventually helped out by her stepdaughter, Sherry Blair, wife of former Prime Minister Tony, but she hated having to rely on handouts.
Free home hearing checks for people who can't leave their homes unaccompanied are now available in Coventry. The Specsavers Home Visits Team are now offering hearing checks, advice on NHS and private hearing device options, and earwax removal for city residents who can't get to a store on their own due to a physical or mental illness or disability. The audiology team is headed up by Atiq Shah and new director Tariq Sadiq, who said he was excited to be part of a service that makes a tangible difference in people's lives. He added, "When we visit someone's home, we're not just there to conduct a hearing check. We're invited into their world. We hear their stories, understand their challenges, and build genuine relationships, which is what makes this job so special. It's a privilege to serve the community and change lives through better hearing care, and the team are looking forward to providing exceptional personalised care to our residents in the comfort of their own homes. To find out more, go to specsavers.co.uk/home-hearing-tests or call 0808 239 6098 for information or to book an appointment.
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. Before we move on, I've got one announcement. This is about Bands in the Park, which has been running all summer. The last 2 or 3 events are coming up, all at 2 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on a Sunday, beginning this Sunday, 31st of August, in Knowles Mill Park, where there is a non-stop bop. if it's not raining. Sunday the 7th of September next week is Spencer Park in Earlston, Westwood Heath Band. And the following week, Sunday the 14th of September at Caledon Castle Park, you can hear the Covington Silver Band. And if you want more information, please contact parks@coventry.gov.uk. So those three are coming up just to finish the summer. And now we're going to turn to, well, I was going to say news from the Resource Centre, but of course it's changed.
It has.
News from the Vision Hub. Here's you.
There we are. Hello there. Yes, I mean, even I, from time to time, trip over my words. But anyway, Coventry Vision Hub we are, and Coventry Vision Hub we shall remain. So a few things to let you know about this week. First off, we're going to start with just a little bit of sad news. Mavis Collymore, who used to come to the Craft Club every Wednesday, I'm afraid we found out today on Wednesday that she passed away yesterday at the age of 95. She had been suffering from dementia, of course, and then went into hospital with an infection. And I'm afraid the infection took her. So the Craft Club are all know, but it's sad, really. She was a very lively member of the group. She'd been coming for 2 or 3 years, she was a very enjoyable person to have around, and we're going to miss her. We'll let you know if you want in details of her funeral arrangements, do contact us. When we find out, we'll be able to let you know. Now, coming up this Saturday, we've got the boat trip. There's a canal barge trip on the up in Leicestershire, and Carl is driving, and there are. There's one space come free is what I'm trying to say. So if you're interested in joining on that, you have from when you get this will be sort of published out on the podcast, of course, and if you get your stick probably Thursday or Friday, if you're listening on Friday and it's before 3 o'clock, you need to give us a call, and you really want to come on this boat trip, see if the space is still there. So there's one space free for the boat trip on Saturday. Now, talking of crafty things, as I was earlier, Julia Springer-Hiron. Hi, Julia. Very regular contributor to Outlook. She's making poppies. She's making a lot of poppies. And she is going to sell them. She's been crocheting them. She's doing fantastic work with those. She's crocheting them, and you can put in an order for a poppy at reception here, and I think they're £1 a pop, but they might be a bit more. And half the money is going to go to Royal British Legion and half is going to come to us. So thank you very much for Julia. If you want to get some lovely crocheted poppies, then leave a note about it at reception. There's a list there of people who want them. Now, talking of money raising, on Friday the 5th of September, I can't believe September is only like, it's next week, essentially, so it's a week on Friday. It's the International Day of Charity. Like all the international days, it's an opportunity just to think about charity and what's it for. One of the things it's for is to make donations to. And if you're thinking there, on that International Day of Charity, what a good thing charities are, have a little think about what a good thing this charity is. And if you're thinking of making a donation, we'd be very honoured to receive it. We're always honoured to receive donations. But anyway, I thought I'd just mention that. I mentioned last week that we want to start a new fitness class. So we've had Sophie, who's been coming in and doing training with Chris and Claire and Zoe and a few others. She's now got a new qualification that formalises her ability to provide fitness classes for people with visual impairments. It is quite a strenuous one here. We offer exercise opportunities across the full range of abilities here. So we go from, you know, a nice gentle walk or a bit of Tai Chi through to a bit more adventurous walks. We've got Showdown, which is quite energetic. We've got bowls, and then we've got yoga, which honestly, you know, ties people up in knots or whatever, or unknots them, whatever it is. but the fitness class is definitely going to be at the yoga end of things in terms of your out of breathness at the end. So if you would like to sign up for that, there are a few. It's going to take place at middays on Wednesdays, as soon as we've got enough people together. So you're going to have to complete what's called a Parcue form. We've got some of those. We'll help you do that. But you must be able to walk for 30 minutes at any speed. It doesn't matter. But also the crucial thing here is you've got to be able to get down and up from the floor three times in a minute. So if you can do that, if you can walk for 30 minutes and get down and then up from the floor three times in a minute, then you are eligible to join this particular class.
Do you mean squatting down, or do you mean actually being sitting on
I think it's sitting on the floor and then getting back up again. Yeah, so if you so this will be an hour-long class. Sophie is a professional fitness instructor. We'll be paying her, so this group will be charged at the same rate as yoga, i.e. £8. So most other groups are £6, but this group along with yoga is going to be £8. So if you're interested in doing that, please do sign up at reception. Finally, one of the things I'm just going to sort of throw this out there as something that we understand is going on at the moment. I'm trying to find out a bit more information. In Coventry, there is a system whereby if you've got a minor issue with your eyes or is something that's a bit wrong with them, you will go to one of a nominated group of opticians. It might be Specsavers, it might be the people down the road here in Earlston or various others around the place, eyesight opticians. They will have a look at your eyes. If you've got like minor issues like dry eye or, you know, a bit of an infection, they can sort you out with that. But also they've got the good equipment, so it means they can actually have a look at your eyes, and if you need to get some urgent treatment up at the hospital, they will send you up there. Now, it's a system that's been going for 10 years, and it's partly funded, though it doesn't need much funding, we understand, by the Integrated Care Board. Now, we just heard at the end of last week that system is being decommissioned with nothing to replace it. So we are trying to find out more information about it. There's been very little, if any, publicity about it. We're very concerned, obviously, about the implications for people, because it can lead to more people losing their sight if they don't get timely and appropriate treatment. It also means it's going to impact waiting lists and waiting times up at the eye clinic, amongst many other implications in terms of the in terms of eye health in Coventry and Warwickshire. It goes across the city and county. So I'm trying to find more information about it. I will keep you updated. We will be campaigning on the issue if it turns out that this is indeed what is happening. They're thinking about, say, getting rid of it from the end of October, and then, you know, and then nothing. And trouble is, I mean, you can go to your GP, and your GP is probably absolutely lovely, but they know sod all about eyes, and that's the problem. So one of the many problems. So anyway, I'll keep you posted about that. You know, we're working with Health Watch, we're working with the local optical committee, we're working with Visionary, which is the group that we as a charity belong to, representing local sight loss charities in Coventry. So we've got a good sort of Midlands network about that we're working with, and possibly also RNIB as well, because they've got a bit of muscle. So there we are. That's where we're at with that. That is plenty for this week, and I will... it's not. There's one more thing. Of course, there's the World Sight Day on the 9th of October, and we're having the open day here. In fact, you know, that if the campaign, if we're going to be winding up to it, will be a significant part of that. But we're getting some opticians in. We're going to have people in to demonstrate the Ray-Ban Meta glasses that's linked to Be My Eyes. We're going to have groups out there, so we're going to be bringing lots of people in. If you want to come in, you know, bring members of your family so that they understand what it is that we do here at Coventry Vision Hub, and we will be very pleased to see them. Okay, I'm definitely done now.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Very concerning, that's
it's
an issue, isn't it?
Hugely concerning. I say there's so little information out there, and I'm trying to find it and get straight through to the Integrated Care Board, which is a It's not as easy as it sounds because they theoretically have a building, but nobody works in it.
Right.
So at all, okay. Apparently.
Well, hopefully it'll become clearer.
Yeah, well,
surely,
yeah.
And then.
Yes.
Thanks again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Here's Sarah with this week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, 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 wonderful, wonderful listeners. As you can tell, I'm rather happy. And after yesterday's news, well, you'll have heard it in the news that we now, when I say we, I mean Coventry City, own our stadium. Who wouldn't be happy? And what's more, the sun's a-shining. Right, so we'd had the news in the morning that our owner had bought the stadium. And then in the afternoon, we had the match. Now, it was seen as the 20th anniversary celebration match because it was the same opposition as we played in our opening match of what was then the RICO, but now the CBS Arena, namely at home to QPR. So, could we do it again? I mean, last time we won 3-0. Right, so what happened? Well, basically, we couldn't secure a 3-0 win. But you'll find out in a bit. So, would it live up to all the expectations and the excitement in the crowd? Well, Hadji Wright, ably assisted by Victor Torp and Milan van Avak, helped it on its way in the 12th minute with a goal. City 1-0. But then a few minutes later, Brandon Thomas Asante, or BTA as the commentator calls him, made it 2-0. Whoa, this is going rather well. And then, and a bit after that, Jack Ridoni slid a fantastic strike behind the goalie and made it 3-0. Well, that's what it was 20 years ago. So there was a kind of feeling of, well, at least it looks as if we're going to win. But then Hadji Wright scored again. City 4-0. Before Jack Ridoni made it 5-0 before half-time. Well, it's no wonder that the players were applauded off the pitch. And I bet sales were up in the cafes at half-time. So let's settle down for the second half. Well, I would say settle down, but literally a few seconds into the second half and Victor Torp made it 6-0. And not to be left out of the Brace Club, because Hadji Wright had got to, Jack Ridoni had got to, Victor Torp bagged a second goal and made it 7-0. Now, it would be remiss of me to forget that QPR did get a consolation goal in extra time after a very good kick, it has to be said, from the corner. But that is how it finished, 7-1. What a day. Could it get any better? Well, what happened in the lower leagues then? So, Tier 3 of the women's competition, where Rugby Borough play, Rugby got a victory against Derby in their opening match of the season. And then in Tier 6, where we find Leamington, Leamington scored their first victory of the season. And they've played about, five matches so far with a 2-1 win against Radcliffe, who I confess I've never heard of. But I don't know what happened at Stratford. Well, I do, but in Tier 7, because their match was abandoned when one of the opposition players from Bishop Stortford dislocated his knee. Ouch. Anyway, back to the City just briefly. Now, we play Millwall on Tuesday in the second round of the Carabao Cup, but you won't be listening to this till at least Wednesday. So then our next match is Saturday the 30th, away to Oxford, with a 3 p.m. kickoff for those of you like me who will be listening on CWR. And now we move to tennis, which I'll just alight on briefly before an even quicker alight onto athletics, and then we end with quite a fair chunk on the Rugby World Cup. So, it's been the mixed doubles for the US Open. Now, I've told you about this in previous weeks. It was basically an attempt by the organisers, if you like, to sex up mixed doubles by matching the top 15 sort of women in the singles ranking with the top 15 men or thereabouts. Not a perfect science. So going into the draw, there were 15 pairs of these sort of manufactured doubles and one specialist, the people that won the tournament last year when it was a normal mixed doubles event. And they changed the rules in the early round. Instead of playing to six games, they were only playing up to three games, and then they would go to a tie break to six. I'm sorry, but tennis has been around for yonks now. Why mess it up? So it was with great delight that I'm delighted to say that the existing title holders retained their title. So well done to Sarah Ferrari and Andrea Vavasori. Well done. Actually, they had the last laugh. Because of this new souped-up format, the winning prize was $1 million compared to the $200,000 they won last year. Just one more on tennis. I was delighted to see that ahead of the US Open, Lloyd Glasspool, the relatively local lad, and Julian Cash, the doubles, the male doubles pair, have been named as world number ones. So well done, you two, and keep it up for the US Open. Now, just touching briefly on athletics, that Keely Hodgkinson's done it again. I mean, she had a layoff with a hamstring injury for 370 days. And she only went and won the 800 metres at the Brussels Diamond League event. Looking very good, Keely, ahead of the World Championships, which start in September. And I was a bit saddened, but not surprised, to see that Michael Johnson's brainchild of the World Track Series, four sort of Grand Prix, which only feature track events and whereby the athletes are actually paid by him and under contract to him, has run out of money. Launched this year, it doesn't look as if it's going to happen in 2026, because basically the athletes have said, no pay, no way we run. As I said before, on this recording actually, if it ain't broken, why fix it? Now, very, 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 very quickly, before I move on to rugby, just want to give you a heads up for any of you who are missing your F1 Grand Prix. The F1 series has taken sort of like a midterm break, but resumes next Sunday, that's the 31st, with the Dutch Grand Prix. Right, sharp intake of breath. And now we go to the Women's Rugby World Cup. Now, the opening match was between England and America and, well, the USA. And it was staged at Sunderland's Stadium of Light, the home of Sunderland FC, basically. And it started with an opening ceremony, which I sum up as, what the hell was that all about? I mean, it started fair enough with our captain from 2014, the last time England won the World Cup, walking onto the pitch, proudly holding the cup, which looked very heavy, and she had to do quite a long walk across the track or across the field. Anyway, she made it. But then it was followed by about 10 minutes of incessant warbling by a singer, a British singer called Anne Marie, who suddenly shouted out, "Welcome to the World Cup!" "Yes, we think we know we're at the World Rugby Cup, Anne Marie." Or if anyone had gone for a Sunderland match, they A, would have been a week too early, and B, would have got a hell of a shock. Right, so on to the match. Well, after kick-off, we were actually very quick scoring, and we scored a try and we converted it, which meant that England led 7-0. And then we went and did it again, 14-0. But then we let the States come back, 14-7. But one of their players shortly afterwards got yellow carded, although the commentators were disagreeing amongst themselves about whether it was fair. Now, a yellow card in rugby union is not like in football where it's just a warning. It means that the player must serve 10 minutes off the pitch. And while the States were down to 14 players, we scored twice more, which made it 28-7. And then into the second half, it became 33-7, at which point I stopped looking at the scoreboard and just concentrated on the match, which was very good, although you might think it was one-sided. And actually the result was, because the final result was 69-7. Tweet about that one, President Trump. Now, on Saturday, Scotland, I'm afraid, thrashed Little Wales, 31-8. Never mind Wales, you still have the best national anthem. Meanwhile, then, on Sunday, Ireland beat Japan, 42-14. Now, the rugby sort of has a rest week before resuming next weekend. We're going to be very busy on the 30th and 31st. Anyway, Wales kick off the play on Saturday the 30th at 12 p.m. against Canada, followed by Scotland, who play Fiji at 2:45. And then the big match for both of us, England play Samoa at 5 p.m. But Ireland have to wait till the Sunday again, when they take on Spain at 12 p.m. Cool, what am I going to do? I've got 3 rugby matches and a football match on the Saturday and an F1 Grand Prix and another rugby match on a Sunday. I know, I think I'll get a life. And that, my lovely, lovely listeners, has been your sport this week. Bye.
Thanks to Sarah for the sport. Yes, she says it's great to see how women's sport has become mainstream. What with the Euros and now the Rugby World Cup, and fingers crossed for all of our four nations teams. Well, I'd echo that. Now here's Dave Monks with this week's Postbag.
This is Postbag. Discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag again this week. We begin with Graham making the correction to something I said in postbag regarding synaptics.
I'd just like to correct something which Dave said regarding speech recognition. Synaptic, I never said that synaptic was free. It certainly isn't. It's I don't know how much I paid for it, because it was included in the price of the phone which I bought from Synaptic. It basically splits the Android main menu up into 6 pages to make it easy for us to select whatever it is we want from the screen. And then when you click onto something, that will also be in multi-pages. For example, if you call something up on YouTube, you get about 8 pages of videos, about 30 videos to choose from. Synaptic have an arrangement with Samsung. It only works with Android. I don't know if you can download it onto any other phone rather than a Samsung, but they have an arrangement with that company, so everything that you buy from Synaptic is a Samsung product. And they do other things like tablets and things, included a smartwatch, and I still can't think why I'd want a smartwatch. It's far too much information. All I want from a watch is to know what the time is.
Thank you, Graham. Sorry about the misunderstanding. I was referring to an app who Jag Singh told you about called ChatGPT. I tried installing it, but I got a notice asking me if I wanted a free trial followed by payments if I was interested. I couldn't remove the notice, so I eventually removed the app. I probably did something wrong, but let us know if you've used ChatGPT. Not so long ago, an offer of a job in Postbag by Jag Singh resulted in someone coming along to do his paperwork for him in his business. Now Jag needs a gardener. Do you know of anyone who can help? Here's Jag.
Buddy, it's Jag Singh, and I hope you're all enjoying this beautiful weather that we're experiencing. I'm just putting a shout out to the universe and to Coventry and to the Postbag family. I live in Coffinham, and I've got a garden which I had a really good gardener who's just maintained it. Simple task, clearing back hedges, keeping on top of the lawn. But unfortunately, he's now decided to retire. So I'm hoping I can find somebody or some recommendations just for somebody. Nothing complicated, and I have all my own tools. I supply the petrol mower and the strimmer and everything you need. It's just literally somebody who's got much better eyesight than what I have and can get themselves to Finham, and I'm happy to pay whatever is reasonable and agreed. So if there is anybody out there that you know and can recommend, please, I'd be very grateful if I could be contacted on 07792 581465. That's 07792 581465. Many thanks, and hope to hear from somebody soon. Take care.
So once again, Jag is on 07792 581465. Well, he won't need a tractor to do the garden. Two members of the Monday Club, Elizabeth and Connie, had a birthday party at the Monday Club. Elizabeth used to work at Massey Ferguson that made tractors, and she invited her fellow worker, singer, Campbell, to come along and entertain. He brought along his friends, Moz, and his son Martin, and together they made up the old Grey Fergies.
Where the strawberry beds sweep down to Lippy, you washed away the worry from my brow. I love you well today, and I love you for tomorrow. If you ever love me, Molly, love me now.
I'd like to thank everyone who attended our birthday bash on Monday. Connie and I had a beautiful birthday bash on Monday morning, and I'd like to thank everyone sincerely for their kind messages and lovely presents, etc. A wonderful, superb morning. Thank you everyone so much for coming.
Oh, the summertime is kind, and the leaves are swiftly moving, and the wild grows among the linden heather. Will you go, lassie, go? Can you sing it? And we'll all go together to this wild mountain high, all around the linden heather.
and Elizabeth wrote in her diary, "What a wonderful morning. It couldn't have been any better."
We watched the three birds fly. We had lovers on the wing. We had dreams and songs to sing. It's a lonely round the field of Athenry. Well, it's a lonely round the fields of Athenry.
It was a great party and the Monday Club was packed. And now here's the latest report from Julia entitled, "My Friend John, Who Went to Bed with His Trousers On." I go back a long way to Tipperary with my friend John. I met him back in the 80s. No, not the 1580s, the 1980s. I could still see then, so I know what he looks like. Horrible. We met at the Butts College and did English and computer lessons. When I left college, he would cycle to where I lived in Skipton Gardens to continue teaching me. Wherever I lived, he would turn up. I couldn't get shot of him. In 2012, David Monks asked him if I could write for Postbag. I've written a piece almost every week since then. Last year, my friend John took poorly, so he's not allowed to have sweeties anymore. I like my friend John, even though I tease him sometimes. I think he likes me too. I hope we may continue for a long time. Anyway, enjoy the last of the summer wine, everybody. Love from Julia. Thank you, Julie. That was lovely. And thanks also to John, who has encouraged Julia with the reports for Postbag. And it was John's idea in the first place, so thank you to John, and please get well soon. And now here's Graham, who's been concerned about the proposed city stadium.
Well, I've just heard on the news that Coventry City FA, KFC, Football Club are planning for a new 40,000-seater stadium. It's a little bit big, I thought. I think the current 30,000 is not big enough now. Now they've struck success, but I think 40,000 is a bit adventurous. But they first of all approached the rugby club apparently, but they weren't interested in developing the Barker Butts site. So they've approached the council to try and find a suitable site. This is a bit worrying, I think, really, because their current contract at the CBS runs out in 2028. And even if they go ahead with a new stadium, I'm sure it will take more than 3 years from start, from design to completion. And, well, they could finish up without a home again come 2028, which is a little bit worrying, I find.
Thank you, Graham. You must have heard by now that Coventry City has bought the CBS Arena, so they've now got a permanent home, and that's fantastic news. And now we hear from Edwina, who's got another helpful tip for you, cleaning the house with lemon juice.
Hi, everybody. It's Edwina. I'm just going to talk about lemon juice. A friend of mine has only just told me about lemon juice. She uses lemon juice for many different things. And she told me that she uses lemon juice to clean her copperware. She collects copperware. She said you can cut a lemon in half and you can clean copper and glass. She also told me that she never uses bleach. She uses lemon juice as a weaker bleach. She does a lot of her household cleaning with lemon juice. And also, she mentioned her continual use of her oven. When she wants to clean her oven, she puts together lemon juice, bicarbonate of soda, and some vinegar, and mixes it into a paste. And then she spreads the paste on the oven while it is warm. She then covers it with a damp cloth and closes the door and leaves it. The next day, she then opens it and uses a damp cloth to clean and wipe. It gets your oven clean like magic. That was a surprise to me. So I thought I would let you know. Whether you will want to do that, I don't know. But she is very practical and very natural with a lot of the things that she deals with. Not all the industrial-made products. Keep smiling, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina, and for your messages this week. And please let's hear from you next time. I'm sure that you've got lots to talk about. Perhaps you've got a tip that helps you around the house. So please pass it on to your fellow listeners. Okay, and talk about your holidays or anything that's inspired you to talk in postbag, or send a letter if you wish. Okay, thank you very much. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all we have from Postbag for this week. Please keep your contributions coming. This week's wander into Warwickshire takes us to Maxstoke, one of the most historic villages in North Warwickshire, complete with a ruined 14th century Augustinian priory and one of the country's oldest continuously inhabited castles.
In the Domesday Book, the village was called Mashytone. In 1170, according to pipe rolls, it was Makestoke. This part of Warwickshire was forest, and would account for the meaning of a place ending with stoke, meaning stockade. Stockades were built as fences for animals for safety from intruders and wolves. Max was from a local man known as Macca. Sir William de Clinton, who built the castle, now lived in by Michael and Rosemary Featherstone Dilk and family, founded a chantry on the side of the church in 1333. And dedicated it to St. Michael and All Angels. A chantry was an endowed chapel where masses for the dead were sung. In 1342 he developed it into a priory, which played a vital part in the local economy. It kept beef and dairy herds, and its produce was sold at Coleshill Market. The village is much as it was, except that the school has closed. The golf club is now where the prisoner of war camp was built in the Second World War, overflowing into the park, a much loved place for walks. The village still has its characters. Charlie the mole catcher, with his dry sense of humour, can do any job you want him to and will always have a tale to tell. He will always be particularly remembered for his work of relaying the path of the church, a real work of art. The farms are now edged with a motorway and crisscrossed with gas and fuel pipelines. And underneath all that is a coal mine, but still the farmers carry on.
A long, long way from Warwickshire, explorer Mark Wood talks to the Monday Club about taking disabled children to the Arctic.
I've just got a couple of stories to tell you.
Oh.
And one of them is about young children in Coventry. Have you heard of Sherborne Fields?
Yeah.
These young children, there's about 270 children in a school just about a mile away from here. And they've all got different disabilities. Some of them are partially sighted and blind, but they've got sort of physical, mental sort of issues and that. And this school is the happiest school you will ever wish to go into. They're just full of life, full of naughtiness, full of happiness, full of politeness. Everything's great about them. And over the last 10 years, I've been guiding certain children on Ben Nevis, Snowdon, Scarpell Pike, mountains in Ireland, just giving them a better experience of, you know, pushing them against the odds, really. But about, when was it? Probably about 3 months ago now, I went to a place called Svalbard, which is an Arctic region of Norwegian Arctic region, the highest settlement in the Arctic. And basically, I took 10 disabled children up there. Now, these children aren't meant to do this sort of stuff, but one of them's in a wheelchair. He's got cerebral palsy. And when you go and see him, when I first met him, and I'll be honest with you guys, I always have, I didn't know how to talk to him. I didn't know what to say, you know. I didn't know how he communicated. But he is a guy who is, there's nothing wrong with him whatsoever, apart from his body doesn't function well. So his brain functions well, and everything inside, it's almost like being trapped inside a body that wants to operate. And I had to learn that, so it was a real learning process. It's a bit like when I first came here, David invited me quite a few years ago now, and I was setting a screen up, and he came up and said that a lot of these guys are partially sighted or blind, and I was about to show you loads of photographs. And that's when I learned I needed to be descriptive for your group. So going to the Arctic 3 months ago, we had 10 disabled young children, we had 5 teachers and 6 of my guys. And my guys are ex-special forces, soldiers, expedition leaders, etc. So really good team. And from going from a school in Coventry to going dog sledding across the Arctic, sitting with dogs, heading off for 5 hours, ride into the Arctic, temperatures of around about minus 20, then getting on snowmobiles and heading further out past where the dogs could go, ride up into the, where we train for North Pole expeditions. This is where, you know, teams of us, like special forces guys, go out and really hardened areas. We took these young children from Sherborne Fields out into there to experience it. And they also went deep into the mountains as well, in these natural ice caves, where they squeezed through these small holes to see these beautiful caves. We took a cameraman along with us, who filmed everything. And I wrote the schedule for the expedition. I wrote dog sledding, snowmobiling, ice caves, lectures, meals. I wrote everything. But what was on there that I didn't write was the best thing that happened out there. All right, so I'll leave this with you, with this last thought of mine. Something I didn't expect happened, and it was the best thing. Even now I feel like, wow, you know, I feel so proud. My team of so-called experts were sat inside a building, and we could hear screaming and laughter outside. So we went outside, and you've got to think that it's all a big snowy area. Imagine Coventry just covered in snow and ice. And we went outside, and all these children and teachers were on this hill, and what were they doing? They were throwing snowballs at each other. And that's right. As we used to do when we were kids, in Coventry covered full of snow. I remember in the 70s, my dad throwing snowballs at me. So they were throwing snowballs, and I saw this young lad, Kian. He was sat in his wheelchair as a cerebral palsy lad. And he was laughing, but he couldn't get involved because he couldn't, you know, go on the ice and that. So this is what happened. Just a sec, mate. The teachers picked him up. The teachers took him onto the ice. They put him on the ice, and everybody piled snowballs at this young cerebral palsy. And now, if you told that in court, it would sound pretty terrible, wouldn't it? You know, how dare you? This lad's face had a smile all the way from the Arctic back to Coventry. And it's just incredible. It's the best thing. Of all the experiences I've done, I've met some of you, but a lot of you I haven't met. Yeah, I've been to the North Pole, the South Pole, Magnetic Pole, 30 expeditions, Mount Everest, all this sort of stuff. But when you take children who are perceived to be a certain person, a disabled, you're disabled, you've got a label on you, you're partially sighted, you've got a label on you. It's more than that, isn't it? There's a lot more to you than that. There's a lot more to these kids. So that's what we brought out of them. So, and at the end of it, I was about to go home, and then David always has this, I can hear David's voice in my head. It happens every week. I'm like, what's that noise in my head? And I could hear him going, remember to send us a message like this. So I got on the sat phone, and I did a little update for you.
That was smashing, that really was.
Our next item is the story of Sabina, who sold the big issue to earn money to save secure accommodation. This is part two of A Stray Called Menace, written by Jane Warren and read by Bill.
Sabrina turned to selling the Big Issue magazine, scrape a living. You buy it at cost and sell your stock at a profit, she explained. After the attack, I kept my school books in a box in the Big Issue office, and I kept studying. I saw qualifications as a ticket out of there. Soon, she had earned enough to get secure, rented housing. Menace went with her. I didn't have anything, but I had my dog, and he represented structure at a time when it was easy to feel lost. Once securely housed, Sabrina says she started to wonder what else could be a reality. I realized I wanted to be able to do something to help other people when they are feeling vulnerable, to give them the support I would like to have received. And that's what attracted me to the fire service, because I know what it felt like to be having the worst day of your life. At the age of 18, she became a part-time firefighter and then took a full-time position. I would have moved anywhere. There is something very special about public services and a wonderful opportunity for social mobility. It's a huge privilege, she says. In return, she says her mainly male co-workers were compassionate, and, she says, took me on the strength of who they believed I could be. Her experience of teenage homelessness has given her an armory of skills to draw upon. Rough sleeping makes you hypervigilant, she explains. I was anxious a lot of the time and able to see small details. I learned to spot risks and to calibrate my reactions. There is life after homelessness, and I am living proof of that. The training in fire and rescue is so good, but incidents can really affect you. Sabrina still remembers being called to the scene of a road traffic accident to discover a newly married couple returning from their honeymoon. Unfortunately, the husband had died. Those are the times that make you think the most. It was another critical incident where a fellow firefighter was killed by an electrical fault that motivated her to study an open university degree in her free time. That incident changed everything, she says. I found it extremely difficult to deal with because I thought my partner was the dead firefighter, and I felt a massive sense of guilt of not wanting it to be him. That's when I started looking into what we could do to reduce human error. Sabrina took a degree with the Open University before completing her PhD in behavioural neuroscience at Cardiff University, where she is now an honorary fellow, supervising several neuroscience PhD students. Before taking on the top job in the coastal county of West Sussex in 2019, at the age of 36, Sabrina, who is married with one daughter, led the fire service response to major incidents, including the Westminster Bridge and the Finsbury Park terror attacks, and the aftermath of the Grenfell Tower disaster. In June, she was awarded the King's Fire Service Medal for distinguished service and gallantry, following her award-winning research on incident command in the emergency services, has influenced policy globally. And in 2023, she was appointed the Prince of Wales's ambassador for his Homewards project. One of the things the Prince is really keen on is making sure he's listening to people who have experienced homelessness, so we can try and do things that are really practical. With Sabrina, also the fire service's national lead for working dogs, by his side, that ambition seems to be assured. For me, it's really important that people understand how powerful the human-animal bond can be when you don't have anything else in life, she says. As for Menis, he stayed with her when she bought her first home, got married, and had her daughter. He died in my arms, a very old and much-loved dog, at the age of 14, she says. I'll never forget him.
Even if you are sometimes at the mercy of Mother Nature, there's nothing like a life afloat, says author and Thames dweller Georgina Moore, who lives in one of the UK's largest houseboat communities. Taken from the Daily Express and read by Margaret.
There's an eternal fascination with houseboats. And when you live on one, you really have to get used to all the questions. The most frequent being, but isn't it really cold in the winter? The answer, in case you were wondering, is no. We have central heating, and because the boat's made of wood, it warms up fast. Anyway, even if it was a bit cold, it would be worth a few months shivering for the idyllic summer months living on the glittering water alongside paddleboarders and rowers. The other question is where I keep my clothes and shoes. In a wardrobe, of course. People often confuse canal boats with houseboats. They're chalk and cheese. Our houseboat on Tags Island in the River Thames in Richmond-upon-Thames is more like a floating two-story home than a canal boat. It has mains electricity, main sewage, a garden, and even a parking place. Our island has 62 houseboats around its perimeter, some in a lagoon in the middle. They are all attached to steel girders deep in the riverbed and don't have engines, so they're not going anywhere. Most of the time, once you're on one, were it not for the incredible views, the occasional noisy geese and the light reflecting from the water all around, you could easily forget it's not a traditional house. Like traditional houses, we still have to pay council tax and all the usual bills hit us the way they do. And on one of the downsides of a houseboat life is you can't get a mortgage, so you have to be a cash buyer. It's something that puts a lot of people off. But if we were trying to buy a house in the Hampton Court area with river views, there's no way we would be able to afford it. With something like 15,000 Britons living afloat and with 1,000 of those based on the Thames alone, we're not that unusual, though it can sometimes seem so. And it really is lovely. It's only when things go wrong that you remember it's a houseboat and different rules for living apply. I am a born and bred Londoner who moved to the island for love and for a man who was already a die-hard islander. It was a shock to find out how different it is here to an anonymous life in the city. The differences include just how much closer you live to nature, for better and sometimes for worse, and how much closer you get to your neighbours. Since then, in my 15 years as a houseboat dweller, I've learnt that we are more at the mercy of elements than traditional homeowners. For instance, the 2014 flooding meant that our garden was under 6 feet of water and it was almost impossible getting on and off our floating home. A houseboat just rises with the water, but the land you are attached to by gangplank does not. I had two very small children, and in the end, the fast-swirling water just looked too dangerous to contend with had I lost my grip on one of them, so we had to move out for a week to rented accommodation while my partner James stayed, lying awake all night worried that our waterborne residence would slip its mooring. But it's not just high water levels you need to be aware of. Low water due to a slip-up in the management of nearby locks, and you can suddenly find yourself beached on the riverbed, perched at an uncomfortable angle. Nowadays, we have a raised walkway through our garden as a precaution against flooding, so there is always a way on and off. But our neighbour's houseboat once sank after they hosted a party. A hole had been slowly growing in their hull from rubbing against a rock, and another lost his floating home in a fire. You live in fear of fire on a houseboat because they're wood, and also because getting fire engines on and off an island with a bridge load limit is hard. Every heatwave you also must learn to fear the sound of a helicopter overhead, searching for the inevitable body in the water, often someone who thinks they can still swim after they've had a few drinks and the sadness and loss afterwards. Spring on the island can be an extremely nervy time, willing on the swans, geese, ducks and coots, and hoping they will be better parents this year. The island WhatsApp group is always full of photos of the cygnets, goslings lining up as people count and check in with them. It's heartbreaking when you see these numbers dwindling day by day, the powerlessness when you hear a duck shrieking because a mink has eaten one of her ducklings, or reading that three cygnets were lost over the weir. Then there's the constant ping of the phone. We've got three in the lagoon. Has anyone seen the rest? It can be like a constant David Attenborough documentary going on in the background. We have a real seal in the island's water at the moment. Everyone is pleased to see the carp back, while someone spotted a kingfisher. I was once involved in trying to reunite a duckling with the rest of the family using food thrown off a paddleboard. A separate emergency group is available for when things go wrong. Perhaps someone's hold has flooded and they need a pump, or the sewage or water system is switched off for repairs. Maybe someone needs help rescuing a canoe that has come adrift in a storm. It's a close community. It has to be. I always compare it to a floating village. You know everyone and everyone socialises together. Age and upbringing do not present barriers. Artists and creatives abound in the community, united by the water views and the singular nature of the lifestyle. They're also drawn to the history of the islands here in the Thames. Tags Island, Eel Pie Island and Doily Cart Island all have a musical and artistic legacy. Tags once had an old hotel owned in 1912 by the impresario Fred Carno, Charlie Chaplin's agent, where he entertained guests with music in the Palm Court. Upstream at Eel Pie in the 1960s, teenagers came to see bands like the Rolling Stones perform exciting new music in its crumbling hotel. Now Eel Pie is home to a thriving artist community. Doily Cart, a private island in Weybridge, was also owned by an impresario, It was recently bought by someone aiming to reawaken its musical history by hosting opera performances under the stars. All in all, Bohemians love it here. You are very aware of the seasons on a houseboat, of course, and life changes quite significantly at different times in the year. While houseboat life can be quiet and private in the winter, over the summer months the river is crowded and noisy. My home office is a small canal boat called Betsy, moored alongside our houseboat, and when I'm on a Zoom, my colleagues have got used to seeing bare-chested paddleboarders going past inches away from my windows, or otherwise large groups of swimmers with bright pink tow floats, or big white boats with everyone pointing or making comments about our garden. We're just opposite a rowing club, so I must sometimes put up with the chattering of teenagers who often bash into our houseboat when they're learning, or the yelling of the cocks into their megaphone, "Hold it hard!" There's always something to look at, neighbours to call out to, and during lockdown we were able to pull up along our neighbours on a canoe or paddleboard and have a glass of wine, remaining in the water while they stayed on their balcony. In summer, you can get in a kayak and you can chase a sunset. But it will also be lovely when we get the river back to ourselves once summer ends. We will go back to living with just the prehistoric call of the heron as it swoops over the island for a soundtrack. Do say hello next time you're passing.
We're staying with Mother Nature for our next feature as Bill Gibb takes a look at the work of the Mid-Derbyshire Badger Group. This is from the People's Friend magazine, read by Elaine.
They are the UK's largest land predator, with the badger's distinctive black and white stripes making them such a familiar sight in our countryside. Living in large family groups in burrows or sets, they love to use their super strong front paws to dig for food. But sadly, a badger's lot is not always a happy one, and be it from road accidents or attacks by other wildlife, many end up injured and needing attention. But help is at hand, thanks to a novel initiative by a group of badger lovers. Mid-Derbyshire Badger Group have already had heartwarming success through the establishment of a purpose-built badger rehabilitation unit. Now they are aiming to add to that success with their second bespoke unit. This time there will be two berths within the unit, which will have all a badger needs to recuperate, always carefully monitored from a camera observed by a willing volunteer. The group is marking its 35th anniversary this year, and over that time it has gone to the aid of countless badgers across the county. "We average one call every week," member Fred Dyson says. "Often it will be from someone who spotted a badger that might have been hit by a car or is otherwise in trouble. Sadly, many will be dead, but when we go out to check, we can find they are just injured. In that case, we'll take them to a vet for examination and treatment. Those that are well enough are then released to us for rehabilitation. Previously, we've just used sheds and garages, but those aren't ideal. When the badgers are healthy enough, they can be quite destructive, as they understandably try to get out and away. After good results with the first unit, they've been working hard again to get the £12,000 required for the imminent installation of a second unit with double the capacity. Like the first, it will be in a secret location and has been custom designed. It's like a much smaller stable, wooden, and with reinforced mesh," Fred says. "It will have two units with insulated floors that are easy to clean and an outdoor area where they can get some exercise as they feel more like it. Our volunteers will go along to check on them two or three times a day, change their bedding and replace their food. There's also a camera so we can see what they're up to without disturbing them, as you don't want them to get too used to humans. Volunteers know the signs that a badger is healthy enough to be released, sometimes just by trying to escape. They are then taken back to close to where they were found, as it's important that they return to their native habitat. We release them at night, and their behaviour is often quite bizarre, Fred says. They trot off, get about 10 metres away, and look over their shoulders, almost as if saying, "Thanks, bye folks." They are lovely little creatures, and it's incredibly rewarding to see them go back into the wild.
Finally this week, our wandering monks, Dave and Graham, take a trip to Bristol, travelling on an open-top bus from Weston-super-Mare and reporting from a hot tub in Bristol Lido.
Hello there, big welcome to Weston-super-Mare. And I'm sitting with Graham on top of an open-top bus. This is great. We're staying in Bristol. So why are we staying in Bristol, Graham?
Going to see Concord, yeah.
So we're going to see Concord. Fantastic. Yeah, right.
The pier has a go-kart track on it. It's not as quick as the other go-karts because of the space, yeah.
But have you been on it?
Yeah, it's very good, yeah.
Great. Great stuff. Okay, well, there's a second pier here, Burnbeck Pier, a much older pier, been disused for some time, and there's a lifeboat station on it with a slope that goes down to the sea. They plan to refurbish it, but it does need some refurbishing. Hello, I'm speaking to you from Sandbay, are we?
Yeah, Sandbay Kiosk.
Great.
So
yes.
Hello, I'm speaking to you from Sandbay Kiosk.
Yeah.
Where we have a huge range of ice creams, lots of things like Mr. Whippy, huge walls range, luxury tubs, milkshakes. I've been here for 5 years.
You have, yes.
In the area of Kew Stoke, which is just the next bay along from Weston-super-Mare.
Yeah.
We have had a very, very busy weekend. Unfortunately,
yeah,
we've been bombarded
stuff.
With ladybirds. They've been swarmed with ladybirds like theirs, but it was like a plague.
Really? Are ladybirds a nuisance then?
On the hot weather, the ladybirds come out. Yesterday, lots of people in Weston had to close. The kids were traumatised. People were coming to this bay because it wasn't quite as bad as it was in Weston. But yes, it was really, really bad, and it only happens every 20 or so years.
Do they?
Yeah. Yesterday was swarming with them.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sandbay? There's two islands out there.
Yeah, there's Steepholm and Flatholm. They're sanctuaries, nature sanctuaries. They used to be able to go over to them now, but unfortunately, I don't think they allow that anymore. Yeah, we've got the second furthest tidal stretch anywhere in the world. It goes out miles. The Coast Guard was called on Saturday to two ladies who went out too far, and the helicopter was put up and the hovercraft, and they came here for an ice cream, extremely embarrassed. They were absolutely embarrassed as anything, because they were the spotlight, because everybody saw them getting off the hovercraft. Yes.
Well, I've come back on the open-top bus to the centre of Weston-super-Mare. I can see Steepholm from here, and that is owned by the Kenneth Allsop Trust. And Kenneth Allsop was a journalist and broadcaster. He was on the BBC Tonight programme with Cliff Micklemore. He later became an environmental campaigner, and he campaigned against open cast mining in Snowdonia. Hello, we're in Bristol, where we're staying the night. So what interesting places are there?
The former BBC headquarters just down the road. They do a National History Unit based there with David Attenborough and Spring Watch, Autumn Watch, that sort of thing.
They're all fantastic programmes. Brilliant. Well, Graham has brought me to an outdoor Lido. It looks very nice. Lots of sounds of splashing water. People swimming, enjoying themselves. Here we are. And then afterwards, we're going to have a meal here. So we're having the whole experience. I'm told it's about 25 degrees today, the water, because the sun's been shining on it. Let's hope for the best. Here's the man swimming along doing the crawl. You can hear the splashing of his arms and legs. Hi. Hello there, I'm in the Lido. We've just been for a swim, and we're in the jacuzzi at the moment, or hot tub. Okay, so what do you think of it?
Yeah, it's good. It's got palm trees, looking like a little cabin, open cabin. See the clouds above you.
Oh, wonderful, isn't it? And when we first got in, what was it like then?
It's a bit cold, yeah.
It was a bit.
You've got to get used to it, yeah.
Yeah, so I think after a while we sort of plunged in, didn't we? Right, okay, right. We're in the hot tub, and I'm up to my shoulders in the hot tub. I'm speaking to a gentleman now. Where do you come from?
I come from Bristol, local.
Bristol, yeah. That's not far away, is it?
Not at all. Round the corner.
So, do you come here very often?
Oh. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm not trying to chat you up.
Well, I was hoping to. Once every few months, yeah. But it's my first time in the experience in the swim and the jacuzzi, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I understand the water in the main Lido, that's heated, but it helps by the sun.
Yeah, mildly heated. So there's still a bit of a chill with it, which is why we're sat in the jacuzzi now. But it's certainly warmer than the seas. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's your name? Were they last?
It's Roman.
Roman. Wow.
Yeah. No. Wow. No letter. Well, no important letters after my name. So.
It's what the Romans did for us. Have you been to Bath for that thermal spa?
I used to work in Bath. Yeah.
It was absolutely wonderful. Yeah. It's heated by the way the Romans heated it with natural hot springs.
That's right. Yeah. It's a good day out. You should do your next show from Bath.
Yeah, that was fantastic. It really was.
Yeah, I might see you there, David.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. Okay, I'm in the restaurant now. This kind of Victorian Georgian buildings all around the Lido. It's quite unique, really, and people are still swimming in the Lido. You can see them through the window of the restaurant. So what do you think of the whole experience?
Yeah, very good, yeah.
It's excellent, yeah. And we're going to have a nice meal now. And then we're going back to the Washington Hotel for the night.
That just about brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.